Hello, is this on?
Okay, so once again, that's Marcus.
Great, thank you very much. I'm glad to be invited today. Thank you to ORCA and to Fields Institute and to Dr. Jeffrey. Please don't be distracted by the title. It's just a clever ruse in order to show you a bunch of cool pictures. A little bit about myself. I work at Princess Margaret Hospital, which is just down the corner at the University Avenue and College. My background is a computer science undergraduate with an applied mathematics postgraduate, which turned out to be very clever because if people ask you difficult computer science problems, then you're really a mathematician. If people ask you difficult math problems, then you're really a computer scientist. So you can dodge a lot of bullets that way. Is it possible to turn the front lights off? I got a black background, so it'll come out a little better. Yeah. Is that okay? Is that readable? So just an overview. My mandate is usually to take mathematical problems and solutions and turn them into bulletproof software, which sometimes is a contradiction in terms, of course, as the Mars orbiter and the Ariane 5 rocket and the Patriot missile and that kind of proves. And as Clifton mentioned, that always constraints of time to market, return on investment, et cetera, that kind of stuff. So I'm always looking for tools that are robust, quick, and reliable. And so that's where MATLAB and Maple come in. So I do almost all the prototyping in MATLAB, some work in Maple, and then turn those tools through various means into software that runs in an online fashion. A little bit about Princess Margaret Hospital, opened in 1958. Its current location near the Hydro building on the corner there was in 1995. Really pioneered the use of cobalt-60 for radiation therapy through Dr. Harold Johns. He's a bit of a legend, I guess, in medical physics circles. Right now, we do 8,200 courses of radiation therapy. That was last year's statistic. So it's a very, very large and busy clinic. We have 16 medical linear accelerators, which are very large, enormous, expensive pieces of equipment. And that's the largest radiation therapy facility. I should have to double check that actually statistic. So it's a very active research area. We're associated with the Ontario Cancer Institute, which is also associated with the University of Toronto through the Department of Medical Physics. So what does a medical linear accelerator look like? Well, they're very large machines which can deliver high energy x-ray beams, and they really have two axes of rotation. There's a rotational axis here, which the gantry of the medical linear accelerator turns on, and there's another axis here, which is labeled B, which the couch, which is called the treatment couch, actually rotates on, and those two lines, axes of rotation, intersect in the middle, which is called the isocenter. And so the idea is to treat to an isocenter so that you can always shoot at the same center. So what that will do is it'll maximize the dose at the isocenter and minimize the dose from around the way you come in. So you come in from multiple angles to try and maximize the dose in the middle. And so the principle behind it is there's something called a therapeutic ratio. Cancer cells or tumor cells are more radiosensitive than normal healthy tissue. And so the idea is to irradiate the tumor cells, and you do this over multiple treatments over multiple days, usually called fractions over weeks. So the idea is that when somebody is diagnosed with cancer, they'll come in, and the first thing they do is they take a CT scan of the area of interest. And so that would be what this cross-sectional slice is here in the black. And then that's following the principle of measure with a micrometer, mark with chalk, and then cut with an axe. The radiation oncologist will come, and he'll outline the tumor. This particular tumor site is a prostate, so we do a lot of prostate treatments. Radiotherapy is very popular for prostate because it's very difficult to use other means. It doesn't respond to chemotherapy. It's very difficult to do surgery in that area because of all the other things. And once the radiation oncologist has marked out the area that they're interested in irradiating, where the tumor is, they also mark out other critical structures. Here's the rectum. There's also bladder, femoral heads, other things that you want to avoid. So the optimization problem is trying to maximize the dose to the tumor, minimize the dose to everything else. And it's a very interesting optimization problem, actually. And so those color washes there are isodose contributions. distributions over the treatment volume. And so the idea now behind image-guided radiotherapy is to not just one of the problems with this kind of imaging modality is this picture is taken at the beginning of therapy and it's used, it's static in time. It's three-dimensional in space, but static in time. The big push now in medical imaging and radiology is to do four-dimensional imaging. So not only do you image in the three space dimensions, you also image in time because things move. And we've been able to show through CineMR studies that the prostate is really quite active because it's right in the area where the bladder's filling, the bowel gas is passing, all these kind of things cause that target to move around. So you're trying to irradiate this thing with very tight tolerances, irradiate the tumor. You want to make sure that you get the tumor to maximize the kill of the disease, but you also don't want to cause complications around. So there is margins that are drawn around the tumor volume, but the bigger the margins, the more complications that you're going to have later on. So the idea behind image-guided is that you image, you target, and then you treat right at the time of treatment. And so it has put some kind of constraints on it. One, you have to have it integrated with the medical linear accelerator. The other is that you have to have a fairly fast acquisition time, and you have to have a large field of view because you have to be able to do the pelvis. That's probably the largest area to image in the human body. So the modality that we chose is called cone beam CT. So it's very similar to CT standing for computed tomography. So it's very similar to X-ray computed tomography or CAT, CAT scans. But a CAT scan will only get a two-dimensional slice. So it'll send out a fan of X-rays. This is the X-ray source here, which rotates around the patient. And in two-dimensional CT scans, it will send out a slice of X-rays, and you'll get a slice at each of those. You get all the projections around, and then you back project them into the middle volume to reconstruct the area that you're interested in, and then you move the patient to the next and get the next slice. Well, with the benefit of cone beam CT is that you can get everything all at once. You do one rotation around, boom, you got the whole image. You got multiple radiographs from all different directions. You take those radiographs, you back project them into the treatment volume, and you get a high resolution volumetric image that you can use for analysis. So the really enabling technology for this is large area flat panel detectors. These detectors are they're a scintillating material on the top, which changes the X-ray photons to optical photons, and then there's a silicon amorphous silicon panel underneath, which reads those out. They read out very fast. They can get up to 30 frames per second. They're 1,024 pixels by 1,024 pixels, so 1 megapixel, 16 bits of resolution in the intensity, but they're also very expensive. And that technology is starting to get better, but it's still not quite there. That's about $250K US for one of those panels, so it's kind of limiting in where you can actually use it. The platform that we're using is called the ElectroPrecise RP, which is research platform. There's four of these in the world. We're the third to be installed as a prototype machine in Beaumont Hospital in Michigan. There's one in Christie Hospital in Manchester, UK, and there's one that's just been installed. It's coming online next week, Monday. So what it is, the treatment couch is sliding here. This is showing the isocenter of the machine. You have the treatment head, which sends the high-energy photons or high-energy electrons down. The head has all kinds of shielding and fingers that can kind of shape and bend the field into any shape that you want. And what we have here is we have a retractable X-ray tube, which comes out on this side, and a retractable flat panel detector, which comes out on that side. So the idea is the patient would get set up, get in the treatment position, you do one rotation, capture the images, build the volumetric image, and then you use that for the segmentation and targeting and then treatment. And so this is a little CAD drawing. So this basically shows what it's... there. Oops, it's going a little slow. So this, the amazing things actually work. There's huge machines that have a vacuum system on them, a high-frequency RF system on them. They have cooling, all kinds of things. And it's all kind of encased in this big drum. The drum weighs about five tons. And so we have this thing, we have to rotate it around, we have to very precisely measure its position, and then use that in order to reconstruct an image. So So here's showing the first patient images that came off. I was in Manchester in September, and these are the first patient images. So what this is imagine you're sitting on the detector and you're rotating around. You see the swallow there? The patient swallowed on the way through. And so you get about 300 projections all the way around. I just turned this into a movie, and it should loop around again. So imagine you're sitting on the detector and you're watching, and you're just taking various projections all the way through. You get those projections, and then, but the problem is that the projection actually is just like a regular radiograph. It kind of lumps all the anatomy together, so bones are on top of bones. You do the back projection, and that allows you to separate out the structures. You can also, I think you can see the treatment coach rolling through. You see that kind of thing that washes through. It's a carbon fiber treatment coach, which is better than a metal coach, of course. So then basically what we do is we take this and put them into a filtered back projection algorithm that written by some fellows, very clever fellows in University of Utah. The difference between our filtered back projection and other people's is that most pixels push. So a pixel is what's on the panel. So this represents one of the projections, and we reconstruct into a volume, and those are called voxels. And so most algorithms, the pixels push the data out. So you push the data out and then show what voxels it kind of back projects in. So you equally sort out what this intensity image tells you, and you kind of divvy that up with a straight line back to the source, what that's telling you. But our voxels actually suck, which is very good, because what you can do is these voxels, so a voxel will go and find out which pixels are appropriate to it and then pull them out. And so the nice thing about that is that you can just pick a certain plane in the reconstruction volume and then reconstruct that. So our voxels suck, and they're better. So there it's showing, it goes through one voxel at a time, pulls out the pixel that's appropriate, and steps along. And so you repeat that for all the number of voxels, for all the number of projections. So it's a really big computational problem. We have a high-speed reconstruction engine which chews away at this. It takes about 6 minutes right now. We're hoping to get that a little bit faster because the patient is on the treatment coach at the time. So there it represents the projections I showed you. This represents the reconstruction of that. It all put into a movie. So all this is axial slices moving up from the neck up to the top of the head. So there's a kind of a cylinder of the field of view is actually cylindrical shape, and that shows what can be reconstructed. So you can see some artifacts there from the fillings in the teeth. The patient actually had a wire on his nose for alignment. They do that sometimes. He creates some artifacts. So now this shows on a anthropomorphic skull phantom. So this is actually somebody donates their skull to science, and they take it and put this kind of molded rubber around it, which has the same similar radiographic properties to muscle and tissue. And I use these for research. So this just shows one where you've made the reconstruction, and then you've kind of peeled all the skin off digitally. And then looking at different slices, so this is a transverse slice through the midplane. This is a coronal slice, so looking through the front to back, right through the spinal cord. And this is a sagittal slice. So you can see really good detail. So the point of this is that right now, we can create up to 0.25 millimeter voxels. So that's a 250 micron voxel. So very, very high resolution images. So this will just blow up of the actual field of view. So the largest part of the field of view right now is 25.6 centimeters. I can zoom in on this area here. That shows me some extra detail and take it right down. So here you can see this little teeny bone. I'm not even sure where that is. I think that's in the base of the neck. You can see the outside of the bone is a little darker than the inside of the bone because the outside is stronger. You can see kind of a little structure inside. So that's one of the interesting things that they do is you want to know what kind of frequencies the system can pass. So what you do is you hit it with a delta function. Well, what's a delta function look like in imaging? It's actually a steel wire. So you take a steel wire, very thin, stick it in a water phantom, and then you image it. And so ideally, that should come out as a delta function, but of course, there's all kinds of things that are going to cause blurring because of the system shaking around, because of X-ray scatter, because of various other kind of things. And so this function here gives you an idea of what kind of spatial resolution you can actually get. And you take the Fourier transform of that, and you get what's called the modulation transfer function. And so if this was a perfect delta function, then the Fourier transform would be a straight line across. You'd be able to pass all frequencies, but you can't pass all frequencies. Now, when you talk in imaging terms, it's not frequency and time, it's always frequency and space. So the larger spatial frequency, the smaller things you can see. And so that starts to tail off as you get things smaller and smaller. You just can't do it. That's limited by the pixel pitch on the panel and all those other kinds of issues. So one of the things that we don't want to cause to have problems is to have geometric calibration causing problems. So you can imagine that this is a very large piece of machinery and it's kind of bumping around rail. It kind of sags with gravity and various issues like that. And so we want to be able to account for those kinds of problems. So the way we do this is just take a high contrast object, which is just a 3/8-inch steel ball bearing, and you place it at the isocenter. And so that is fixed in space. And now you see what the images look like. So this is really a first order correction. All we do is we assume that all the motion that you see in this ball bearing is caused by the detector, and then what that gives you is the piercing point of the detector. So the piercing point is where the central ray from the X-ray focal spot comes through and hits the panel. Okay? So I have a projection image here of the ball bearing. Okay, so this is the ball bearing put at isocenter, and to the untrained eye, that looks like it's exactly in the same spot on the panel. But if you actually put the mouse right on top of it, put my finger there, you can see that it just slightly moves around as you go around. So there it's at the one edge of the ball bearing, and it kind of lifts up and goes to the other. And so that represents gantry flex. We're in a spatial coordinate now that we're sitting on the detector. So it looks like the ball bearings are moving, but it's not. We're moving. And so we have to account for that movement by adjusting the projection. So we take each of those projections and subtract out the movement that we see on the ball bearing. And so that's a first order correction. So this is just a little graph that shows the pulling out the two spatial dimensions out of the ball bearing. So we find the centroid of the ball bearing and pull out the two spatial dimensions. So this is showing versus gantry angle. So you can see it kind of sags and goes up again. There's a little spike in here, I think, where the extraction of the ball bearing failed. And this is in the this one is in the perpendicular to axis of rotation. That one's in parallel axis of rotation. So this is by far the largest. It's about 5 pixels, which represents about 3 millimeters. And so this is just showing the same thing in phase space. And this is in a unit of millimeters. So you can see that as the thing rotates around, the ball bearing kind of moves. And actually, interesting enough, this is from the prototype machine in Michigan. It actually has a hysteresis effect. Depends on whether you rotate clockwise or counterclockwise. It actually does a different trajectory. And it's because this thing is on, it's two big kind of drums which are on like rails. And when you, the drive wheel is on one side of it. So when you crank it one way, it tends to shift it this way. When you crank it this way, it tends to shift it that way. And so they actually have to know not only the gantry position, but how you got there, whether you went clockwise or whether you went counterclockwise, which is kind of interesting. The data that I showed you here is actually from the Manchester, which didn't exhibit that hysteresis effect. So simple approach, we take out the centroid versus angle and give a first order projection map and use that for the reconstruction. So this shows if you have the correction on and if you don't have the correction on. So this is the skull phantom again with the correction on. This, the middle one, is with the correction off. What if you don't do the pixel map correction? So you can just see, you can especially see it on this one here, you can see a bit of blurring around this kind of sharp edges. And this one here shows the difference image. So if you subtract those two images, then there's a definite difference between them. And it's not so much for the human eye, but it's very important. We want to take this information, put it into automatic segmentation, looking for edges, that kind of stuff. So you're going to give your computer start a much better start if you can subtract out those kind of artifacts. So now the next generation of geometric correction. So that was a simple first order one. This is where I thought I could use some computational algebra. And this is, the ink's still pretty white on these slides. So instead of just assuming that the BB is moving in the detector plane, you have to also assume that the detector is tilting in two different directions. And so now you have to get all this extra information. Not only you need to know this is the world coordinate, so this is on the axis of rotation. You need to find out where the X-ray source is. You need to find out where the corner or the center of the panel is. Plus, you need to know the normal. It's pretty good assumption to assume that panel is a plane, so it's flat because it's mounted on a rigid structure. But it might be tilted in any particular direction. So you need to estimate all those parameters. And so this is work done by Frederick New, and one of our physics residents at PMH is working on this, building a phantom which can exhibit this, and also the calculation routines which can extract this out. And so this is, if you take a phantom that's not just a ball at the isocenter, is that you have two different balls, off-center on the height and off-center on the axis of rotation. When you do a rotation of that, it'll actually trace out a circle because you're rotating the thing. When you take that circle and project it onto a flat plane, you're going to get an ellipse. And so now what the goal is you extract all the parameters of the ellipse, and then you take that ellipse and you can throw it into those equations. And you extract out all the parameters. So the center of the panel, all that information, plus the angle rotation. And so that was really good. Now, what we wanted to do is we wanted to see what happens if there's error in our extraction of those ball bearings. Or there's digitization error because you take a picture of a ball bearing and throw it onto a digital panel. And also, what if we don't pick up the edges just perfectly? And so we wanted to do a sensitivity analysis on that to figure out what were the sensitive parameters to that. And we were able to do that numerically with numerical derivatives, but what about having one with analytic derivatives? And so I didn't want to go through and differentiate that expression. This is actually a simplified expression, assuming some simplification of that geometry from before. So the one that's the full expression is actually even a little hairier than this. So I thought this would be a great application for Maple. I just haven't got around to doing it. So also, when we're moving through our projections, we don't use absolute referencing. We like to have relative referencing. So you start at a point, and then you move based on delta parameters. You know that you should move this, you should move that, and that's a lot quicker in terms of the calculations. So other uses of symbolic computation. This is things that I just bounced on at various positions that I've held. I found that it was useful for things that were very big and very small. Okay, what was the very big? To work at a place that did large-scale refinery unit simulation. So it would take a component that's in an oil refinery, and you'd construct a model of this, and you'd solve it, and that would integrate into an overall kind of refinery simulation, which was used for operator training. So somebody could be trained at a console in accidents and operation and recovery and that kind of stuff without actually having to go to a refinery. So these were about 10K equations when you formulated. The one I looked at particularly was a chemical reactor that made acrylic acid, and so apparently for a Japanese company, the acrylic acid is one of the essential ingredients in the absorbent material in diapers, and so that's my contribution to chemistry. What happens is it's a system of differential equations, differential algebraic equations. So it's if you look at it in terms of ordinary differential equations, it has a very stiff component. And so they usually say, okay, it's not stiff anymore. Let's just make some algebraic equations and some differential equations, hence a differential algebraic equation set. If you do a backward Euler on that, you get it to a nonlinear set of equations, which you could solve with Newton method. But, of course, you need to have an estimate of the Jacobian matrix. And I found that Maple was invaluable in having that. So you put in the expression, you do the automatic differentiation of it, and then you do the source code generation, copy it to source code so that you can run it later on. And I found that very valuable. But of course, being skeptical, you always have to verify the analytic derivatives with numerical derivatives. So that was the very big. When I worked at Honeywell, I found that it was good for the very small things. So this is embedded systems, so ASIC devices like Clifton was talking about, or control systems, proprietary control systems. The problem is there's no math libraries there. You want to do something which does a simple calculation, but you have to start from scratch. So rather than have the code up, a sure decomposition and then this and then that, and you just go and find the analytic expression you're interested in and solve it using a simple technique. So, for instance, a linear system of equations with no pivoting, you can just solve that using Cramer's rule. It's pretty messy. It's a 5x5 or a 10x10 system. It makes a big wallpaper expression, but you're just going to automatically compile that and embed it anyways. As long as you know the caveats in terms of loss of numerical precision or where the algorithm can go south. I used it for calculating eigen. You can do analytical roots up to order 4. I had an application where I needed to know the eigenvalues of a it was a linear transfer function, and so rather than having to code all the stuff up for eigenvalues, you just get the characteristic polynomial and solve it analytically. If it's only fourth order, you can solve it easily, and you just have to explicitly handle the cases where it goes to complex or whether it goes to real. And so that was a very good application for that. So in summary, my acknowledgments, the principal investigator for this is Dr. David Jaffrey, and that's not a misprint. That's two A's, not two E's. So somewhere back in Scotland, their ancestors changed E's for A's, and I work for David Jaffrey. The cone beam team is Jeff Stewartson. He's a scientist in OCI. Steve Ansel and Graham Wilson are doing software for us. Acknowledge Christie Hospital to where we acquired the images. The vendor for the medical linear accelerator where we've implemented the cone beam CT on is Elekta Oncology Systems out of the UK. And this work is supported by National Institutes of Health, one grant from National Cancer Institute, one grant from National Institute of Aging. So now for the shameless self-promotion want. Help wanted, apply within. And we'll take help in any form. Mathematical help, personnel help, anything. So, thank you very much.